Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to the World Affairs Podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Jeffrey Gordon, and today I'm talking to Nicole Siegel. She is the author of Violence Work, State Power and the Limits of Police from Duke University Press, and it was published in 2018. Nicole is a professor of history and American studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. Nicole, how did you become interested in writing a book about the history of policing, and what is violence work?
First of all, Jeff, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm really glad to be talking to you, especially in this moment when people are once again thinking really hard about what policing is and what its relationship to state violence might be, and what other ways there are of shaping our social bodies and organizing ourselves. So you asked me how I became interested in writing about police. Well, I had been an anti-prison activist, an abolitionist for many years before I started writing about police. And that I came to in graduate school, actually, in the mid-90s, after having lived in California during the riots after the beating of Rodney King. That was my first introduction to disproportionate police violence against African Americans. And it is an experience that I took with me to graduate school in New York City. And I remember very clearly a series of lectures organized by the law school where Angela Davis was one of the speakers, and it was the first time I'd ever heard the term prison industrial complex. That must have been 94 or 95. And it struck me very hard, and it helped me to understand things that I had been doing in my activist life around migration. I was an immigrants' rights advocate in that moment. And it helped me to understand the relationship between migration, incarceration, the military, economic needs of the capitalist democracy of the United States. And so that was the moment where I began thinking and being active around questions of mass incarceration. And I came of age in the moment when people began to call themselves abolitionists, and we began to organize. I organized with critical resistance for many years. And then when I finished the work I had been doing in graduate school that had been prompted by my interests in migration and race in the Americas, which became a book called Uneven Encounters about making race a nation in Brazil and the United States, I knew I wanted to write about the thing that I'd been spending all my activists' energies on, the prison industrial complex. But I wanted to write about it in terms of some of the transnational currents that affected local and, in particular, U.S. conditions. And as I began thinking about it, I realized that the thing that I most wanted to write about was policing, because policing was the thing that seemed to me most clearly to travel and to be incorporating some of the global currents of U.S. colonialism and of the Cold War era in particular, the moment when mass incarceration was shaped and the moment in which the kinds of policing tactics that we see implemented in U.S. cities all over the country right now were developed. Sorry. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
Yeah, so I come at this in a way from the opposite, the receiving end of a lot of this U.S. Aid to foreign country policing. I study transitions to democracy and attempts to consolidate democracy in so-called developing countries. And although this the literature in my field, comparative politics, focuses a lot on how U.S. aid shaped military involvement in politics in a lot of these countries, the aid to policing and the role of police in day-to-day life and the political function that police serve in these societies is really invisible. And so that's part of a big part of the reason why I was drawn to your book, because violence work on a sort of day-to-day level is almost rendered invisible because of some of these ideological distinctions
And I think, you know, it isn't that the powers that be are trying to hide the involvement of police in U.S. overseas interventions. It's just that they get subsumed into the broader framework of military action. They get assumed to be military, even when people are quite open that they're sending over police officers or military police or, you know, some other force that might understand itself in a domestic context as policing. It just gets sort of interpreted into this, what we assume to be going on when U.S. is involved in foreign interventions, which is always necessarily military.
Right. So you call the book violence work because this violence work denotes the range of things that police do that other entities like social workers, counselors, friends and family cannot do. How does violence work get to the heart of what the state really is?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just start by going backwards a little bit and talking about how violence work gets to the heart of what policing does before we get to the state, if you don't mind. Because the book is really interested in highlighting and trying to take apart some of the myths that underlie the functioning of the police. And the first one is the most important one really is this notion that police fight crime. You know, that is the base level assumption. If you ask a regular educated citizen on the street, what do police do? Well, they fight crime. Sometimes people might say they keep order, they support law and order. You know, that's a much more expansive kind of framing. But the link between policing and crime is so tight. And that's the one that I think really needs to be undone. And a cluster of fantastic critical criminologists has worried this knot from the angle of crime itself, talking about what crime is and what we assume it to be, what we allow it to be, what kinds of social harm don't get defined as crime. So I wanted to come at it from this other angle of whether police actually are intended to fight crime. And what you discover when you think about this, even just a little bit shallowly, is that it's ridiculous to think that police are primarily involved in crime. First of all, there have been police for centuries. There's been a notion of the police power for centuries. There haven't been uniformed public police departments, forces for centuries. That started a little bit later, say in the 19th century. But there's been a notion of the police power for much longer. And there's only been an understanding of the relationship between police and crime for about, let's say less than 200 years. So the link between police and crime comes late. And what police actually do in their day-to-day is so rarely involved with crime that it is, it's sort of ridiculous. So people who study the content of police labor, you know, what police actually do on a day-to-day basis, say that police work on crime-related issues less than a tenth of their time or you know, that they're actually fighting crime or pursuing criminals 1% of their time or never, you know, depending on how they define what police crime work is, they find just very, very small percentages of police time actually spent on it. So I start from the recognition that this is a myth that needs to be undone. And I want to think instead about what it is that police actually do. And so I rely here heavily on Egon Bittner. He's a scholar of the police from the 70s and his understanding of the ways that police use violence, which is that police often don't need to use violence because they represent the ability to inflict state violence. They are the organ of the state that is authorized to inflict this famous Weberian definition of the state, the monopoly on legitimate violence. They are the people who get to express that abstraction. And so whether or not they actually, you know, shoot somebody or hit somebody, the police power comes from the recognition that they have the right, that they do in fact have the ability to bring violence into the real world of a human body. So that is that's the reason I want to call their work violence work, is that it makes very clear the exact relationship, not a one-to-one relationship because of the question of scale, right? Police are human scale. The state is this large abstraction, but this direct relationship between state violence and police as the channel of that violence into the real world, into real time, into real space.
Yeah. And I think that that's a really interesting way of focusing our thinking about policing, because as you, I really found it helpful to think through, well, why do we consider things that are crime? Like, why do we, what delimits the boundaries of the concept of crime? Why are things like, you know, day-to-day shoplifting considered crime, but, you know, industrial pollution is not? I think that a big problem that a lot of people have with the idea of defunding the police or abolishing the police is that they think of police work as being so firmly intertwined with this idea of fighting crime that they think that without this potential use of force or actual use of force, society would go to hell and we would all be living in a Hobbesian world of all against all, right?
Right.
You helpfully try to get away from that idea by pointing out that we shouldn't naturalize the concept of crime. And even if we do accept the definition of crime as it exists now, that's not really what police do with a lot of their time.
That's right.
Absolutely. So you talk in the book about three myths that serve to legitimize policing and supposedly differentiate policing from other exercises of state violence that would be problematic in a liberal democratic state, exercises of violence by non-state actors, for example. And the first of these is the civilian-military distinction. We hear this in former Defense Secretary James Mattis's recent statement criticizing the idea of calling in the military to put down protests and so-called riots in cities, that the threat that Trump and Tom Cotton have made recently. When he says that we must reject any thinking of our cities as battle space, that our uniformed military is called upon to dominate, and that militarizing our response sets up a conflict, a false conflict between military and civilian society. And he went on to add that keeping public order rests with civilian, state, and local leaders who best understand their commitments and are answerable to them. But
yeah,
in reality,
one of the other myths as well, state and local leaders, you know, insist
right.
that police are that they're operating in a kind of local frame on a very small scale. That's another critical one.
Right. And that this small scale in some way entails greater accountability to citizens than these larger scales, which is also, you know, historically problematic in the US.
Yeah, I think it's also a question of sort of pretending that the police are, you know, your lovely, benign neighbors. The question of scale is about reducing them to a size that feels human and refusing to recognize their core relationship to the larger abstractions of state and market.
Right. It's trying to invoke this quaint idea of, you know, the policeman that you see walking down your street every day and you say hi to and, you know, you're friendly with, and he's there to protect you against whatever chaos may be in store for you. But in reality, historically, the police and the military have been intertwined from the beginning. How has the U.S.'s history of colonialism and overseas expansion shaped the development of policing in the United States?
Okay, yeah. Let me just start by saying that when you're asking me about the myths that I write about in violence work, mm-hmm. the myth of police being civilian, the myth of there being public, the myth of there being local, you're asking me to think about these borders that help mm-hmm. constrain, contain the idea of police. And the metaphor of border crossing is really useful, not only when you're thinking about actual territorial border crossing, but categorical border crossing. So the categories of civilian and military have this really critical border, which has to be maintained in order for police to sustain their legitimacy in a democracy. And, you know, you see what Mattis doing in the statement that you just quoted is defending the border between civilian and military, because that is what he thinks will sustain their legitimacy. So he sees Trump's actions as threatening the legitimacy of this democratic institution, that is, the institutions that allow our type of democracy to distribute state violence by distinguishing between some violence, which is military, and other violence, which ought to be civilian. So you asked me about the history of U.S. expansion and of colonialism, and how that muddies up the borders between civilian and military. That's a really key question. You know, the U.S. first, obviously, became a nation through its genocidal containment of the people who were here when European powers decided to set up shop on American shores. And then through a series of wars with other European powers, and then with other nations in the Americas later in the 19th and in the 20th centuries. And those actions of genocide against Native Americans and of colonial containment in the Americas, those have been police actions as much as they have been military actions. There has been truck back and forth between military and police forces at every moment. In fact, some historians understand the removal and genocide of Native Americans as much of a police action as a military action. Colonial situations are the places in which lots of the policing tactics of the present were developed. And in fact, the modern police force, as developed by the British policeman Sir Robert Peel, who is the founder of the Bobbies, those were developed when he was in authority in Ireland as part of the British occupation of Ireland, and they were redeveloped in India. They are those forces, the Bobbies, are a product of experimentation in containing colonized populations. We also can't ignore the role of police in maintaining slavery. Police were some of the first forces that were in charge of collecting and returning escaped enslaved people. And police forces that developed in the South to try to contain and police escaped enslaved people were some of the first to take the modern form of police, to be armed as police forces. They developed from the constabulary forces and the colonial militias that were in operation at the time. So slavery, Native American genocide, and U.S. colonialism in the Americas are the roots of modern U.S. policing, and they must be understood as such if we are to understand what it is that the police are actually supposed to do and do.
Right. And we think of a lot of Americans think of counterinsurgency as something that the U.S. and other colonial powers do overseas to try to bring peace and order to societies like Afghanistan and Iraq that are fractured and fragmented. What are some of the examples of border crossing? And here, I think that the Office of Public Service, Public Safety. Right, and that you talk so much about in your book is an example of this border crossing, where the practice of counterinsurgency, the practitioners went back and forth between these overseas places and assisting places like Thailand and Turkey, countries that I'm very familiar with, in developing their own counterinsurgency capabilities, and then bringing the lessons learned from overseas back to the U.S. and fighting counterinsurgencies in our urban areas. So could you talk a little bit more about the linkage between counterinsurgency overseas and counterinsurgency within the U.S. and thinking of you know, U.S. citizens, Black U.S. citizens, as objects of counterinsurgency?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you say counterinsurgency, you're bringing us into the 20th century, and especially into the Cold War. It's a anti-guerrilla fighting tactic or sort of military framework that was developed specifically to counter guerrillas. People who don't have state power, who have to be disproportionate and secretive in the ways that they fight state power. So counterinsurgency involves, even though it's a military tactic, it involves some really key policing type strategies, such as surveillance. And so it's maybe no wonder that the police were so intimately involved in the development of counterinsurgency, and then that counterinsurgency began to seem relevant to U.S. police back in the U.S. in the beginning in the 1960s, when U.S. cities began to feel to city officials and police authorities like the battlegrounds they were seeing overseas, specifically at that point in Vietnam. So if you look at the news and discussions of U.S. urban unrest in the 1960s, you see all kinds of people comparing it to Vietnam and comparing counterinsurgency in Vietnam to the ways that police were encountering resistance here in the U.S. It began to be a kind of understanding of the possibility of resistance, of socialism or communism, of anti-capitalist sentiment, of resistance to white supremacy, colonialism abroad, anti-blackness in the U.S. And you see in particular this body of police and other kinds of violence workers who were organized into an organization called the Office of Public Safety, which was developed in the early 1960s to help militaries fight insurgency abroad. And it was really a minor office in quantitative terms, but it does have a disproportionate illustrative power to help us understand how the U.S. government was understanding the relationship between the U.S. and its engagements abroad. So, let's see. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so... the Office of Public Safety and the career paths that its former employees have had since the OPS was disbanded in 1974 illustrate that people, elites in conservative think tanks and in city halls and in police departments have been thinking of our cities as a battle space that needs to be dominated for some time now, right?
We should say what the Office of Public Safety was and what it did so folks can follow. So it was this, it was an agency that took police abroad to many different countries to help train other nations' police. So it was an agent of U.S. police assistance, which is perhaps an odd term. We're willing to think about military assistance, but more rarely do we think of police assistance. That's what it did for 12 years officially, although it had its roots in other organizations operated through the Department of Defense for several decades before that. But it was made official in 1962, and it existed until 1974 when a series of controversies brought Congress to close its doors and, in fact, to prohibit police assistance across the board because of fears that these police advisors in the Office of Public Safety were teaching torture, were highly political, right? We're practicing political policing, which itself is supposed to be an oxymoron, not supposed to, police are not supposed to be political, and that it was in cahoots with the CIA, that it was a front for the CIA, and that it was involved in setting up torturous prisons, particularly in Vietnam, in South Vietnam. So there were a series of controversies that made Congress bring it to an end, helped in part by some pop culture, in particular a film by a Greek filmmaker that showed some of its workings, and the event covered in some of those, in some of that cultural material, which was the kidnapping of an Office of Public Safety officer by Tupac Amaru guerrillas in Uruguay, a guy named Dan Mitrione, whose kidnapping then became notorious and brought lots of attention to, and he was killed by his kidnappers, brought lots of attention to the question of whether the Office of Public Safety was teaching torture to its police students in Latin America and elsewhere.
The Office of Public Safety not only renders problematic the civil military distinction, but it's also renders problematic the local versus national versus international distinction, right?
It does. Yeah, I keep feeling like you're getting ahead of me though, and I'm happy go with you. But you've asked me a question that I have not yet answered, which is about how why the Office of Public Safety shows us what it shows us, which is because when it ended in 1974, it ended so sharply, and the employees of this organization were furious, and they didn't want to stop what they were doing. They believed deeply in the mission of their work, and so they organized a newsletter which helped them keep in touch with each other. They helped each other get new jobs. They followed each other. They praised each other's movement, and it allowed me as a researcher to track what they were doing and to follow the ways that the jobs that they took on after their organization was terminated and they were fired, to track the jobs that they were doing and how those jobs kind of ran roughshod over these borders of civilian versus military, national versus international, or local versus international, and public versus private. So what I saw then was that many, many Office of Public Safety employees were moving over the border of civilian military into military work. They were moving over the border of public-private into private sector work. And they continued moving around levels of scale from local to national to global and territorial borders, right? Leaving the U.S., coming back to it, traveling as part of their work as they continued their professional lives. Lots and lots of them returned to the U.S. and became police. And some of them were involved in policing the urban areas that became some of the targets of counterinsurgency. They brought back specific tactics. They brought back mentalities, frameworks for thinking about urban unrest in the U.S. that had been shaped in Cold War counterinsurgency contexts abroad. And they also went very heavily and often into overseas work for private companies and domestic work for private companies in the private security industry, which was ballooning at the time. I think a lot of people don't understand how enormous the private security industry is today and how deeply the sort of shadow world of policing is connected to official public policing. We think of cops moonlighting or something as maybe some romantic exceptional state, but the ways that police can cross these borders can work at the same time or sequentially for public and private bodies is really quite striking, because the kinds of work that they're doing is not are not all that different from each other, whether they work for an urban police department or a rural police department, but regardless, a public police department, or whether they work for a private company doing industrial security, or their security guards for any kind of venue, the work that they end up doing is just very similar, and in all cases, they are violence workers authorized to use the violence of the state, even when they're working for a private employer.
Right. And I would like to dig into this public-private distinction a lot more, and how this private security industry should make us reconsider or think differently about the relationship between states and markets than we do now. In capitalist democracies, there's supposed to be a distinction between the state, which serves the public good or the will of the people, and the market, which is a realm of private individuals engaging in contracts for mutually beneficial exchange. Mm-hmm. Police as agents of the state are not supposed to serve any particular private or class interests. Right. And yet we see so many examples, for example, in your chapter where you trace these Office of Public Safety employees as they enter into employment for the private security firm Wackenhut to help defend the Alaska oil pipeline that was constructed in the 70s and 80s. We see these examples where the police are defending whether the same people crossing this boundary between public policing and private security, they're still doing the same work of defending the infrastructure of capitalism. How do you think this private security industry and the relationship between even public police and private industry, how do you think this unsettles this state market distinction that we have?
I think it's crucial. You know, I think, and yes, I write about the Alaskan oil pipeline and the way that lots of former Office of Public Safety employees went to work for pipeline security, which was awarded as a contract to a private security company. I think that's a perfect example of government market collaboration, is in the awarding of contracts, which is an extremely normal way to do business, to get security for some grand undertaking like the Alaska oil pipeline. The ways that it speaks to the indistinction between the state and the market. So there's this notion in, I guess, liberalism, that the state and the market are distinct, and that the market is self-regulating in certain ways. And that notion finds its extreme expression in neoliberalism, this political philosophy originating, or that began to be applied, let's say, in the 1970s, and which has had some great moments of subscription in the last 50 years, which is the notion that the state should get entirely out of the market. The market can be entirely self-regulating. The state should get its hands off. You see this in Trump's adherence to the opposition to regulation. And that's just this magnificent fiction that the state and the market could ever be distinct. Because in fact, even as regulations of some sorts are lifted, the state is facilitating the operation of the market in much more fundamental ways and has done so since the emergence of mercantile capitalism in the last 500 years. Capitalism could not exist without the state form. Maybe not the state form as we know it. Maybe there are other state forms that could sustain capitalism. But capitalism and the state form, the nation state in particular, are deeply interconnected in North Atlantic history and now in world history. Karl Polanyi wrote about this in The Great Transformation, about the ways in which state intervention into the market was necessary, or the market would have exhausted itself in certain frenzies that it leads itself to. You cannot have Jeff, I don't know how to continue to explain this without getting too deep into Polanyi, and I don't think that's someplace that your listeners want to go. Shall I come back to the Office of Public Safety in particular?
Well, I do kind of want to get into this because I do see this as a very common ideological fiction of the idea that you can have a market independent of the state. But one way that I think about how Polanyi is important here is in the idea of fictitious commodities, because the state violence is important for turning land, in the case of the Alaska oil pipeline, into a commodity that can be bought and sold and
for
exploited.
And people who are using the land in other ways.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And
finding the quality of private property and ensuring that just absolute spinal cord of capitalism is respected.
Right. The idea of a self-regulating market presupposes all of these political processes that need to happen in order for land and labor time to be fungible.
And the wage relation is, it requires a state intervention in order to force people into it. The wage relation is uncomfortable. It's violent, and it requires state action to keep people from, going and building sustainable communities like quilombos or communes. You need to force people to stay within land borders. Mm-hmm. You need to force them to operate, your factories. You need to force people to stay within certain very circumscribed limits in order to keep them in a wage relation, to force them to work for wages. So that's where state violence is absolutely critical to the maintenance of any kind of capitalist system.
Right, exactly. And I also think about how this private security industry and public police as well have played such an important role historically in putting down labor demonstrations and stopping any kind of
interference in the normal working. And that's even people who want to be in a wage relation.
They just want to have a little more say in how their workplace is organized. And even that is something where, were it to get out of hand, it would interfere with the self-regulating properties of the market. And so the state needs either the state or these private agencies, the famous historical example the name of that firm is the Pinkertons, right? Of an organization whose job is to put down any kind of labor organization. We see this, we see OPS workers going into these sorts of firms, and we also see it in your chapter on Aramco in Saudi Arabia, where some of these OPS employees were involved in putting down strikes in Jerom in eastern Saudi Arabia. Could you talk a little bit more about that example?
Sure. In Alaska, the Office of Public Safety folks who were working for either private security or public police or the criminal justice system there were doing is they were helping to build this cornerstone of the global oil economy. Timothy Mitchell helped me understand the structure of that and how critically important it has been to the shape of labor and to capitalism in the last 60 years. Then
Carbon Democracy was
Carbon
such
Democracy,
a
yeah.
fantastic book.
It's really,
yeah.
really essential. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and while we're shouting out to key books, just to mm-hmm. come back to this question of the state in the market, I think James Scott on the ways that people have tried to run away from state control and what state
right.
control means in terms of tithing and requirements to stay in certain kind of labor relations. Graeber on debt and Ruthie Gilmore on the ways that in California in particular, the state was managing certain kinds of surplus, like surplus populations and surplus land and labor, how the prison industrial complex or the prison system was essential to that kind of management, in addition to Polanyi. Yeah. So,
right.
Moving along from thinking about that corner of the global oil economy over to Saudi Arabia, lots and lots of Office of Public Safety officials went to work in Saudi Arabia. And in part, that was because the Office of Public Safety had already had such a deep engagement in Saudi Arabia. And it was one of the places where countries were not actually getting this aid, quote unquote, for free. They were paying for it, which sort of boggles the mind. Why is it aid if they were paying for it? But they had been working very closely with certain branches of the Saudi Arabian government for all of the life of the Office of Public Safety and prior. And when the Office of Public Safety folded, the program in Saudi Arabia was one of the ones that the agency's champions thought they might have an opportunity to extend. And in the end, they didn't, but they were able to bid for and people who had worked for OPS to bid for and win a contract to help with industrial security for the oil industry in Saudi Arabia. And then what you see, what I track as I follow Office of Public Safety employees as they move into all kinds of different jobs in the oil economy in Saudi Arabia, are these unbelievably hybrid bodies that have, you know, corporate heads and state torsos and corporate legs and state toes, and then just impossible mixtures of civilian and military, of public and private, of people working at all levels of scale, of people from everywhere with all kinds of training. That's why I think this Deleuzian concept of assemblage is useful, although I would say I sort of take its name in vain because I'm not quite so theoretically precise, but it's an incoherent collection of objects. It helps us remember that these different parts of the system don't necessarily speak to each other. They don't have the same ideas about what they're doing. They try to maintain in their brains these distinctions that they're actually just stomping all over in practice. And it really gives the lie to any kind of coherence of this notion of the state in distinction from the market, notion of the market in distinction from the state. So I use this term that you mentioned before, the state market with a hyphen, because when we think about the two of them together, I think it allows us to understand what's going on a lot better. It allows us to see the ways in which, you know, the state also is heavily reliant on the notion that it's distinct from the market, because that's what grants the state a kind of legitimacy. You know, we're not corrupt politicians, we're not working for profit, we're just simply governing and doing what's in the interests of our constituents, we're representing people, you know, all of these political concepts that allow us to ignore the ways in which the state and the market are functioning together to further the conditions that capitalism needs, to further the conditions that capital needs in order to sustain its operations.
Right. And throughout this discussion, another book that I think about a lot is Deborah Cohen's The Deadly Life of Logistics. It's all about particularly looking at the oil industry, among but also looking at shipping, all the ways in which both state violence workers and private security companies are involved at all levels of the process of
that's right.
Extracting yeah. oil, transporting it, bringing it to market,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Looking at all the ways in which the functioning of a market in natural resources is dependent in so many ways on the exercise of state power.
That's right. Yeah. And before we move away from talking about books and the circulation of police mm-hmm. in urban areas, I wanted to mention before Stuart Schrader's amazing Badges Without Borders. That is really the book. It's much better than Violence Work on the ways that police brought the priorities and the tactics of counterinsurgencies back, of counterinsurgency as a practice, back to U.S. cities. That's a really amazing book about the ways that policing in the U.S. has been influenced by Cold War considerations. Highly recommend.
I've basically read his book and your book sequentially, and mm-hmm. I love how you guys can both look at the Office of Public Safety
yeah.
and write these very different books that are complementary to each other in a lot of ways. And I think that that's really fascinating.
We had to stop talking at a certain point so that the books didn't become more like each other. We were
right.
that we were pulling each other towards each other's interests. So we spent a period after being in very close contact for a while. We spent a period of trying not to talk about all this stuff so that we could create different objects. And then, of course, we did because that always happens. But it was a concern
right.
for both of us.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So I want to pivot a little bit now also to talking about how race fits into the state market and
oh,
capitalism.
Yeah. Thank you. Sometimes
why is race
that
both...
so deeply for granted that I forget that,
right. Right.
that we're not always
absolutely.
Already talking about race because we are.
Right.
Have to go there. Sure. Go ahead.
Certainly.
And formulate your question.
So, why is race both, as you write, a necessary engine and a product of capitalism? And how do police activities produce race?
Oh, gosh. Okay. So racism is an engine and a product of, what am we saying, capitalism, state violence, both? Which is the question. How
right.
should we approach?
Right.
All of the above.
Capitalism, all of the above, right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the formulation of racial difference in a moment of European expansion, of kind of enlightenment thinking and of European expansion into the Americas, Africa, and Asia is a critical moment in the formation of the of the ideas of liberal governance that would go on to be critical to the formation of the notion of the modern state. So this notion, for example, that of the citizen is itself a racialized concept. The notion of the sovereign is a racialized concept. Nationalisms are profoundly racist in the ways in which they envision the boundaries of inclusion and their territorial and imagined boundaries. So the fact that Europe was expanding and using colonialism and genocide as tools for statecraft in the period of the development of the modern state can't be overlooked. Racism is critical to the formation of contemporary nation states because it happens in this through this process of European expansion and establishment. And the labor systems of colonialism, of say, of tithing, of containment, of in both Spanish Lusophone and Hispanophone America, as well as Anglophone and Francophone America, those are all critical kinds of practices. Then, of course, you have the triangular trade, the use of enslaved labor to replace the laborers that disease and the ability to escape was making impossible through colonized bodies in the Americas. And so, without slavery, there would not be the modern nation of the United States in the way that we know it, nor would there be nation states in other parts of the European colonial empire, in the Americas and outside it. So racism is a profound historical precedent. Even if the shape of modern racism was not yet defined, the distinctions that are being made between Enlightenment subjects and others, affectable others, as Denise Ferreira da Silva would say in her book, The Global Idea of Race, Towards a Global Idea of Race, that distinction was crucial to the setting up of these systems, both political and ideological. And then, of course, capitalism generates race as a population distinction, as a way to sustain the kinds of categories it requires in order for capital to accumulate, in order for people to be dispossessed of the resources that they need to remain outside of capitalist systems.
Right. And so, for example, the doctrine of discovery that was used as basically the legal reasoning behind dispossession of Native Americans was premised on this idea that indigenous peoples are incapable of achieving civilization, quote unquote, on their own, and that because they weren't putting their land to good use, being the uncivilized heathens that they are, that justified their expulsion from the land, their loss of use rights over the land, the extraction of resources therefrom, the resettlement of Europeans onto their land because they would bring, you know, this racialized concept of civilization to those territories. Yeah. And we see that that kind of reasoning today in extractive resource economies, like construction of the Alaska pipeline, and more recently the construction of the pipeline through the Dakotas. Exactly.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yes. This notion of progress, of what constitutes, you know, an organized society or a productive society, those things extend the legacies of that much earlier era. Yeah. In terms of how policing produces race and racism, I think one of the most important ways is spatially, right? By policing certain neighborhoods, by hyper-policing certain neighborhoods, by making sure that people aren't out of place, whether it's, you know, Trayvon Martin or Ahmaud Arbery, somebody who seems to be out of place and whose death is then state sanctioned, even though it is delivered by a private agent. Those sorts of inflictions of violence, I think we have to understand also because they are state sanctioned, because especially right now, but not only right now, even when Trump is not in office or someone like Trump is not in office, the ways that we organize the distribution of guns, for example, and the ways in which there has been and probably will continue to be a lack of any kind of accountability for people who inflict racist violence on those who move out of the places where black and brown bodies are supposed to be confined. But policing, I mean, it's impossible not to think about the ways that police exercise immediate murderous violence on black and brown bodies right now. But that's, I think, not the most important way that policing produces race and feeds racism, is an engine of racism. I think it's much more about the ways in which policing is critical to the maintenance of larger systems that are racist, including spatial systems, also occupational systems, systems of land use and resource use, systems of pollution, and therefore health and healthcare, you know, where there are grocery stores, where there is where there is smog and asthma and respiratory disease, you know, and of course, then how crime is understood, how the acts of survival that people are forced to commit because they are confined to poverty, prevented from getting education, prevented from the opportunities, prevented just from earning the same amount as whiter people or white people, Those are some of the critical ways in which police are involved in really deep and profound productions of racialized hierarchies, racialized inequalities. I think it's useful to focus on the more dramatic instances of police violence because it helps us see how it helps us focus rage on policing and think about a world without police. But when we do that, I think it's unbelievably important to remember the police's expression of this larger question of state violence, the police's relationship to these larger concepts of the state market, so that we don't indulge in shallow reforms which don't move us away from the broader and underlying racisms, which are just as violent, if not as dramatic, as police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and other people whose names were chanting on the daily.
Right. We've seen efforts or gestures towards police reform, like body cameras, that it's so easy for politicians at all skills in American politics to say, oh, this is going to solve police violence. Yeah. But we've seen these waves of police reforms introduced that still have not stopped police from killing Black people.
Yeah.
And
we see this one little technological innovation. We say, oh, there's the solution. But the things that folks are calling for, like police accountability or civilian review boards or the greater visibility or prosecution, none of those things are new. They've all been demanded by people protesting police brutality and police racism for decades. And they don't go to the heart of the problem. They allow police to remain this cornerstone of our notion of how our political and social lives should be run. They allow for the permanence of, you know, neighborhood segregation, educational segregation, healthcare segregation, all of these ways in which Black and Brown lives are impoverished, immiserated, shortened. Just having a police force that didn't kill Black people would do nothing against those broader, panoramas, and they might even grow the prison system, because if we're not interrupting the police's relationship to the criminal justice system, we're still allowing police to be the funnel that takes Black and Brown bodies and puts them in prisons and other situations of confinement. The
right,
thing that I'm most worried about right now, if I can take a little tangent away from violence,
sure.
Maybe you can tell that I have not been thinking about violence work, the book, that is, much at all. Recently, I've been thinking much more about what's going on in the streets. You know, the thing that I'm most worried about right now is that there is a broad common sense building against police violence, and it dovetails with the broader common sense building against mass incarceration, you know, where you have seen even very mainstream politicians take a stand against mass incarceration and even call it mass incarceration, which is a term of critique, which they have embraced. And when you have that very broad mainstreaming of a radical political message, I fear that it will be channeled into the kind of reform that will disrupt absolutely nothing. And in particular, right now, I think we should be really worried about the forms of surveillance, of which body cameras are one. Body cameras are feeding our sense, are the kind of reason that a lot of people are subscribing to right now, that visibility is all, that monitoring is everything. And this plague of electronic monitoring that we are inflicting on people as punishment and as probation and parole, post-punishment monitoring systems, is terrifying to me, because I think it's one of the outlets that I suspect energy for reform will take, is that, you know, okay, so let's put some electronic monitors on nasty police, on people with complaints of brutality against them, the way we've been putting monitors now on people who are coming out of prison or jail, or people who are sentenced to monitoring as a sentence, you know, recognizing there that it's punishment, whereas when it's post-sentence, we say it's not punishment, it's just a condition of their release. They have a conditional release, and monitoring is one of those conditions. And it's just toxic in the extreme, because I don't think we realize that we're building prisons out of filaments of the cloud. We're building electronic, we're building digital prisons. And they have the potential to be as confining, as immiserating, as impoverishing, and as sickening as brick and mortar prisons. I could go on about that a lot, but
absolutely,
there's other people who are thinking about that.
That's a fantastic point. And when we think about the involvement of people like the Koch brothers who are starting to get into criminal justice reform, because they're not coming at it from a racial justice perspective. They're coming at it from a, well, prisons are expensive, let's find cheaper ways to monitor this underclass, rather than thinking about rather than trying to address the deeper political economy that renders black and brown people as a surplus population that's not invested in by any of our institutions, that's spatially segregated, as you pointed out, and prevented from having access to opportunities that so many people take for granted.
I don't think people understand that electronic monitoring is not just like carrying your phone in your pocket. You know, the cost and the consequences of the costs of electronic monitoring are sky high. The consequences, first of all, judges who assign people electronic monitors sometimes give them greater punishments, longer sentences, although suspended, than they would if they didn't assign the electronic monitoring. And these things are extremely easy to mess up. And so it's very easy to violate the conditions of a probation or parole with electronic monitoring, because they lose signal, they lose charge, they have malfunctions very frequently, and people are always blamed for the malfunctions of their devices. And the costs are unbelievable. They are that people have a setup fee of like $100 to $250, and they have a daily fee of $10 to $14. It varies widely. It varies by county, by state, by company, depending on what company is providing the quote unquote service. And if you cannot pay, then you are once again in a situation of violating the terms of your conditions. And these kinds of conditions are inflicted on people who don't fully understand what they're signing up for, or if they do, are so desperate to be out of the brick and mortar prison, maybe because they want to, you know, be involved in raising their children or have an opportunity to support, you know, their families, or just continue their education and the building of their work lives and careers, that they accept them or they don't read the fine print. And people find themselves in these unbelievable situations where it works out worse for them. They owe thousands and thousands of dollars, and they find themselves again facing long prison sentences, this time for violating the terms of electronic monitoring. So we can't just think to ourselves, well, it's, you know, like wearing a Fitbit. It's absolutely not. And you know, if you try to take one off, or if one malfunctions and you're blamed for it, you can be convicted of an attempt to escape, which is itself a felony. So if you have a misdemeanor and you get an electronic monitor and then something happens to it and you're convicted of an attempt to escape, all of a sudden you're a felon. So there are many ways in which this current regime and its prospects is terrifying to me. And I hope that people will not allow themselves to be lulled by the euphemism of electronic monitoring. Now, one thing I am really excited about are these calls to defund the police. That is something that we haven't seen. And you know, the fact that the Minneapolis City Council has decided to endorse this policy, that's unusual. And that's exciting. To disarm, to defund, to diminish the police overall, those are non-reformist reforms. Those are reforms that take us along the path towards police abolition. I'm sorry if I misspoke and said that Minneapolis wants to disarm rather than defund. It's defund, right?
I think it's defund. That's what I've read, at least.
And here in Bloomington, my hometown, people are calling on the police force to disarm. Both of those things are fantastic, and neither one of them is succumbing to the temptation to think of police as civilian, right? Like the call to demilitarize, which reinforces the idea that police are civilian. To disarm the police is not a call to demilitarize. It is just a call to get them to stop using these really lethal weapons. Of course, it wouldn't have helped George Floyd, but it would have helped a lot of other people, and it will, it would be a step in absolutely the right direction. So I hope that folks, as they're thinking about these things, will allow themselves to think about the distinction between reformist reforms, which grow the system, and real reforms, which move us towards a different kind of system altogether. And, you know, I would also say to folks who are feeling despair that a lot of people aren't involved in changing the police directly, but they're doing other things that are building the world that we want, the world we want to see. People who are, you know, carefully and beautifully raising their and other people's children, who are creating gardens and sharing food, who are setting up systems where neighbors can look out for each other when their kids are teenagers and do age-appropriate kind of obnoxious things, you know, or, you know, ways that we can set systems up for each other, ways when we harm each other, that we can bring each other to account and make amends and help make things right in ways that don't involve the police and that don't rely on state violence for their ultimate underpinning. I think those people who are doing that, you are really doing the work of building a better world. And whether or not you are involved also in protesting or, you know, we need everybody doing all of those kinds of work. We have room for people who are now protesting, including rioting and looting and attacking the police. We need those people for the kind of dramatic impact and the expressions of rage that fuel the energy of other people who are doing other kinds of building. You can't have only one piece of that puzzle. So I'm really grateful to all the folks who are doing all the different kinds of work right now that is not leading towards banal reform that will take us back into the system. People who are doing all the building and all the destroying that we need alongside each other in order to move towards a really different world.
Okay, I think that that's a good place to wind up our conversation on this message of hope.
I'm sorry that I got so far away from the book. You know, the book came out two years ago, and
I understand.
I do think that its core insights are still useful to folks, but frankly, what's going on now in the streets is just more useful.
Right.
I think
it's important to think about things like the state market relationship and the role that police play in reproducing racialized capitalism, to understand the longer term trajectory that we need to take to not just implement these piecemeal reforms, but to have much deeper social changes to reduce the role of violence in our society and sanctioned violence in particular. So for that, I think that Violence Work is a terrific book, and I really learned a lot from it. So thank you very much, Mikkel.
I really appreciate your interest and your particular contribution to this great labor, this great collective task, which is before us.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.